That was an interesting topic.
I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order. Good Monday afternoon to everyone. It's May 4th. We have two Senate bills up before us today, Senate Bill 141A and Senate Bill 188A. And I believe we're going to start out with a public hearing on Senate Bill 141A. Victoria, you want to give us a preview of the bill?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 141A requires real estate commissioner to establish escrow agent licensing system by rule, provides criteria for escrow agent licensing system, requires fingerprint and background check for initial escrow applicant or upon change in ownership interest in escrow agent or for corporate officers or individuals in charge of operations, allows commissioners to require additional information from escrow agent licensee or applicant, grants discretionary powers to commissioner for implementation of escrow agent licensing, allows commissioner to impose disciplinary action for demonstrated incompetence, failure to maintain surety bond, and acts of fraud or dishonest conduct substantially related to applicant or licensee fitness, even if conduct did not occur in course of escrow activity, requires escrow agents to follow written instructions of principals in escrow transactions. This bill was voted out of the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs unanimously and passed in the Senate 27 ayes, 1 nay, 2 excused.
Thank you. And on the sign-up sheet, I bet you we have somebody from the Real Estate Commissioner's Office. So we'll have up Ms. Skillman. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Consumer Protection Committee. If you would identify yourself for the record, please.
For the record, my name is Laurie Skillman, and I'm a manager with the State of Oregon Real Estate Agency. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have provided a section-by-section analysis of the bill to you, and I will provide you a short summary of that section-by-section analysis, but that's for your information, and it's on details in the bill. The Senate Bill 141 was a result of a collaborative work group composed of the real estate agency staff, members of the real estate board, and 11 members of the escrow licensed escrow agents. Just as a point of information, there are only 50 escrow agents, at which are companies licensed in this state. The group met about five times over the course of 6 months to review all of our administrative rules. It was a complete rule review. And during the course of that rule review, there were a number of changes that the committee wanted to make but were unable to because of statutes. And we went through all the statutes, took a close look at them, and they hadn't been touched for a number of years, and so a number of these provisions in this bill are housekeeping amendments, amendments made for clarity, for readability, and so on. There are six major purposes to the bill. First are the housekeeping changes that I discussed that update archaic language and provide definitions to clarify the existing statutes. For example, the bill allows for assignments of certificates of deposit to be used in lieu of a surety bond requirement for escrow agent licensing. This change allows licensees flexibility in meeting that surety bond requirement using modern financial instruments that weren't available in the statutes. Second, it provides procedural aspects for the existing licensing system for escrow agents. Everything to do with licensing for escrow agents is in statute. The way that we changed that was to provide by rule for the licensing of escrow agents as the agency does for brokers, principal brokers, and property managers. We still have all the provisions that were in the statute for licensing listed set it out so that we could establish by rule how to do that. Third, Our existing statutes require fingerprints and a criminal background check on the application or renewal of escrow licensees for individuals who have ownership interest in the escrow licensee. However, if it's not on application, if it's not on renewal, and there's a change in ownership, there were no provisions for requiring new ownership interests to go through a criminal background check. So we didn't find out about that until after the fact. So there are provisions that amend our existing statutes to allow us to do those before we they have to provide the criminal background fingerprint information, and we approve it. So there's just an approval process. Fourth, there were two new grounds for discipline that were added. That means that the agency can license sanction a licensee for different violations of the statute or rule. The first ground for discipline is for the licensee's failure to maintain a surety bond. That didn't exist. We thought that was important. And then the second is for a licensee. It provides the agency with the ability to reprimand a licensee. Currently, we have a sanction to suspend or to revoke a licensee, and a reprimand is a much lesser sanction and provides the agency with greater flexibility with our licensees. And finally, the bill clarifies that escrow agents not only have written escrow instructions from the principals to the transaction, but they must follow them. That it was just kind of sort of this missing sentence in the statute that not only do you have to get them from your principals, but you have a responsibility for following the instructions that they give you. There were amendments to 141. After we got the bill back and started taking a look at it, we realized that there was a provision in Section 11 that seemed to conflict a little bit. It was a real technical amendment, just to kind of eliminate some potential conflicts. Some sections weren't noted and so on. The amendments are consistent with the intent and purpose of requiring escrow agents to follow these instructions from principals. Either from the principals by written agreement of the principals or from a court order. And the amendments eliminate any redundancy and conflict that existed in the bill as introduced. That's it for my testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions that you or the members of the committee may have. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that walk through the bill. It was very, very good. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I heard you say that there are 50 licensees. Is that right?
That's correct.
And I'm not an active, but I hold a real estate license.
Yes.
Not since we changed to broker, but back when we were agents. And all agents had to have a license, not just the principal agent or the broker.
Correct. But
what I'm hearing is that escrow agents don't have to have a license, just the principal of the person who owns the business. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Riley, that's correct. A escrow company gets the license. So we don't, for brokers, principal brokers, and property managers, we license individuals. For escrow agents, we license companies. So for Chicago is a licensee. FATCO is a licensee.
Follow up.
So the employees, the folks who are actually doing the work, sitting out at the table with the principals, do they have to have these background checks and fingerprints and so on?
Through the chair, Representative Riley. Only the individuals who are required to have a background check, and I can point you to the section of the bill that describes that if you give me just a moment. It's on page 4 of the bill at the top, that section 5, it kind of describes that. An escrow agent that's not an individual may satisfy these requirements by providing fingerprints and conducting a criminal check on just this group of individuals. If you have 5% or more interest in the escrow agent, so it's the ownership interest. Second, if you're a corporate officer in charge of the escrow operations, or third, if you're in charge of escrow operations for the escrow agent. So certain corporate officers that are in charge of that, or if you're in charge of operations at, say, a large branch, those people.
Okay.
Basically, if you have decision-making authority over money, you have to have a criminal background check.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? I'm not seeing any at this time. Thank you very much bringing us this bill. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 141A? Not seeing any. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 141A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 188A. Victoria, would you please give us a brief description of the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 188A authorizes the Department of Agriculture to impose civil penalties for food safety violations and to adopt rules to implement civil penalty schedule. Provides for penalties not to exceed $10,000 for each violation, clarifies penalty classification, and reorganizes penalty provisions under relevant statutory sections. Amends statutory provisions related to livestock inspection violation to resolve statutory conflict, makes violation of livestock inspection statute or related rule Class A misdemeanor. Senate Bill 188A was voted out of the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs unanimously and passed the Senate 29 ayes, 0 nays, 1 excused.
Thank you. I have Lauren Henderson and Vance Bybee. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Welcome to the Consumer Protection Committee on the House side. And if you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lauren Henderson. I'm the Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I have with me Vance Bybee. He is our administrator of our Food Safety Division. Senate Bill 188A is an agency bill. It would provide civil penalty authority to ODA's food safety program. I've handed out, or she's in the process of handing out, a one-page summary. And then with that is a more detailed section-by-section detail of the bill. And at the chair's pleasure, I can get through the brief summary. And then if you'd like us to go through line-by-line, we can do that.
Brief summary would be ample, okay, probably, yeah, at this point.
Senate Bill 188 would authorize civil penalty authority. We currently do not have that in our food safety program. This would affect various chapters of the state law, which is why you have several sections before you. That includes our grocers, our general food, as well as meat dealers and slaughterers, labeling, inspection of meat, dairy, shellfish, bakeries, lock of plants, eggs, beverages, and so forth. Currently, without the civil penalty authority, we have a very complicated regulatory mechanism, and that is really criminal. It's pretty insignificant, it's very time-consuming, and really does not help us get where we need to be, which is compliance. The civil penalty authority, through the administrative process, allows us, and I want to back up just a little bit, our philosophy at ODA is not to immediately go to civil penalties. We work very hard with providing our staff to do technical assistance and work with those licensees to get them in compliance. I can tell you probably the single most problem that this will help us address is those folks who will not get a license and license in the state legally through that license. We have had experience in the past where we've had folks who have gone years without obtaining a license. And that license is really important for our staff to be able to visit that establishment. And at the same time, and I can just give you an example, when we have the recalls that I'm sure you've all heard about, there's been a lot lately, unfortunately, we know who those people are and what they do and can make sure that we get phone calls to them or a visit to those folks if we have recalls so that they know that they're a product that needs to come off the shelf. I think that's a good example of an immediate need to get folks licensed as well as to be in compliance with the state laws for the various things that they're a part of. Frankly, our civil penalty and what we want to do here is, I think, our last resort. We have a philosophy in our agency that if we've gone that far with someone, we've really kind of failed. They've failed, we've failed, because we really want that to be our last resort. And that being said, though, having the civil penalty up to $10,000, and I think that's important, up to, these penalties wouldn't immediately go for an unlicensed firm, go to $10,000. We would establish by rule a civil penalty matrix that would take into consideration cooperation, whether this was a first-time violation and so forth. And Vance can maybe speak to that a little bit more if you would like some information on that. But it also, I think, the civil penalty route is a less complicated, less expensive route for both the person we're working with and our staff, rather than going through the criminal process, which is really overburdened right now with issues. So that's what I have, and we'll be glad to take some questions.
Questions from the committee? It was a pretty long weekend. Representative Wingert has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, I think I understand on the list here things like shellfish, dairy, bakeries, meat, slaughterhouses, egg processing plants, that kind of thing. But you have listed in here non-alcoholic beverages. What would that entail?
Mr. Chair and Representative, my name is Vance Bybee. I'm the Administrator of the Food Safety Division. The Food Safety Division has been given the responsibility for the licensure of non-alcoholic beverages. Non-alcoholic beverages have been determined to be a food product, and as such, they fall under our purview. And so the production of that non-alcoholic beverage is subject to licensure, inspection, regulation, and so it would entail the same qualifications as other food establishments that are licensed.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Lance, give me some examples. What I was looking for is like a Coca-Cola bottling plant. Is that the idea? Who needs to be licensed as a non-alcoholic beverage producer?
Examples of non-alcoholic beverages would be carbonated beverages, juices, bottled juices, bottled water, teas.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Other than the specific list, there's also one here just listed as food. Is that a catch-all, or are there specific types of folks in the food business that you mean by 616 food here? Who does this entail, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Mr. Chair, Representative, food, 616, and food is the biggest, broadest section of the industry that we regulate, and it would include both manufacturing and retail food. So
restaurants?
Not restaurants.
Grocery stores?
Grocery stores, yes. Convenience stores, grocery stores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And gentlemen, I appreciate the fact you've already been through this on the Senate side, but just for clarification, you mentioned the fines wouldn't be greater than $10,000, but that is the limit on each violation. It could theoretically be, depending on how many violations, $10,000 for each. Is that correct?
Chair Holvey, Representative Matthews. That is correct, based on a count, per count in the matrix that was would be developed through that.
Do you follow, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Was there discussion on the Senate? Was there opposition to this? It seems to me that with the language, and I don't necessarily have a problem with the bill, but when it says department may adopt rules establishing a schedule of civil penalties that may be imposed under this section, civil penalties imposed under this section may not exceed $10,000 for each violation. Was there? Did anybody come out in opposition about what this potentially could be to them?
Representative Holvey and Representative Matthews, the bill was amended to bring the civil penalty down from $25,000, which is what the bill started with, to $10,000. And I think that was part of the discussion in advance. You were there, was that?
Right, Chair, Representative. That was part of the discussion. Originally, the language included civil penalties up to $25,000. It was reduced to $10,000. Originally, the Attorney General's office had recommended that there not be a limitation, determining that food safety in the state was that important. And just as an example, the recent peanut recall would be a very good example. Civil penalties have been issued in those cases in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. It would be clear that in an instance like that, if we were to have something, if we were to ever have something like that happen here, which we hope we never would, that $10,000 penalty for something similar simply wouldn't be very effective.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to take advantage of an opportunity that, because you're sitting here in front of us, to just answer some curiosity question on my part. It hasn't been too terribly many years since the monitoring of shellfish was assumed by your department. And so I'm curious if you're doing testing of shellfish and posting of closures and that sort of thing. Is that what your department is doing now?
Chair Holby and Representative Cowan, yes, it is. We have a shellfish specialist and a manager that oversees that program. That program, it has two parts. It has the recreational side and those folks that get licenses from ODF&W, and then a commercial side. We do monitor those closings and post those. We're also doing testing for PSP and things like that. So, yes.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
And I certainly understand the need to go, desire to go to civil penalties as opposed to the methodology you have now. But I'm just curious, what would constitute violating a provision in FSD statutes or rule in the shellfish program? Would that be commercial diggers then, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative, an example of a violation in the shellfish program could be when shellfish purchaser is purchasing shellfish from an unauthorized dealer. Right now, that generally is resolved through the criminal process. The police are involved and used to resolve that issue, but it could be resolved through civil penalty.
One last follow-up. So the commercial harvesters need to be licensed then in order for dealers to purchase from them and sell the product. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that's correct. They do need require a license.
Thanks.
Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lance, because you used the example of the peanut contamination that occurred, I want to make sure that I understand the intent of this bill. Is the idea that it would be reactive, so that when somebody has done something that obviously has brought attention to them and is a food safety violation, they are then fined after the fact? Or is the idea that as you're doing inspections or people are applying for licenses, if you find something that you're concerned about, you then fine them for that violation up to $10,000?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the purpose that was driving our desire to have civil penalties really are two. One is that, as Mr. Henderson explained, the system that we have now to help induce compliance is time-consuming, expensive on the agency's part and also on the licensee's part if they choose to get an attorney to go through the criminal process. And ultimately, then, the fines that go up to about $200 are very insignificant. And so we wanted to move the process into the administrative process, similar to other state agencies and similar to other divisions in our own agency, to make the process easier for licensees who may not be attorneys or have access to attorneys to participate in the administrative process, so it could be quicker both for the licensee and for ourselves, and so that we could have quicker resolution to the issue. The second thing regarding your question is that, again, the civil penalty issue is the last in a very long step of working with our licensees. We say and believe that education is the most important part of regulation. And so there are several steps that would happen before we ever got to a civil penalty. We go out and do an inspection and we may find a violation. If we find a violation, that violation is noted, and we would then set a follow-up visit to see if they could correct the violation. We would have the follow-up visit. If the violation isn't corrected, they would receive a warning with a specific amount of time to correct the violation, and a follow-up visit. After the warning and the follow-up visit, if they had not corrected the violation, then they would receive notification that they could receive a civil penalty. And so there are several steps along the way before a civil penalty would ever be considered to be imposed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Burling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was a pretty long answer, and I want to say what I think you said, and you tell me if I'm right. Right now, you do all of these steps, presumably, but there's no real big stick at the end of the road, and so you don't get as much cooperation. And now you'd like to do those steps with a little more cooperation, and that stick gives you some advantage to get some cooperation. Is that right,
Mr. Chair and Representative Riley? That's correct.
Thank you. I guess I'm going to dare to ask this question. Mr. Henderson, as you know, I have a little familiarity with multiple licenses at a particular facility. And so I'm kind of curious how these sorts of penalties would be levied at a facility where you have multiple licenses. Is that something you will address by rule, or is it something that just will happen depending on who happens to be in control of the facility at the time you found the violation?
Chair Holvey, if I can, it was good working with you on that last bill. I think what would have to happen in there, and we may have to address some of that in rule, but something that our staff does now, and Vance can maybe add to this, is, and I'll give you an example, if there were a facility that had multiple licensees, one of the things that has to happen in that facility is someone has to be the primary licensee, and that person then becomes responsible for, say, the floor drain. And it would be that person, and we would go through some process to identify, and I think we do that now, so that the second person that is licensed in there is only responsible for their activity, and things that are maybe facility natured would not be, unless they were considered to be the primary. And I don't know if you remember our discussions. We had a long discussion about that, trying to figure out how to make that work. But that would have to be worked out in a situation where someone, through what Vance has described, that process to get compliance, and then we reach the end of the road and can no longer get that, who was the primary for that. I think in that case, where it might affect a secondary licensee is if we had to then stop use in the facility and those kinds of things, then they would no longer be able to use the facility.
Just wanted to make sure we were taking that into consideration on those secondary licensees so that they all weren't liable for something that they weren't in control of. But I'm sure your agency would look at each case as presented and make that determination, I assume.
Yeah, Chair Holvey, we would certainly do that.
Thank you. Any other questions? Not seeing any at this time. Thank you, gentlemen, for your presentation of this bill. I appreciate your time this afternoon. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on this bill this afternoon?
Well, guess.
Sure, come on up.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association in support of Senate Bill 188, and I just felt needed to come up maybe to answer any questions. We are supportive of the bill, worked with the division on the Senate side, amending the bill. Was actually surprised because most licensing programs do have civil penalty authority that this one didn't. We were assured, just working with the department on the Senate side, that this would not be a new or replacement tool to the current process, as was outlined by the department. So some of the violations that we're talking about were to bring mostly unlicensed firms into compliance. And I think one of the most egregious examples was, you know, running a meat slaughterhouse out of your garage where you're not getting a license and you're selling meat, where most of our grocery stores will sometimes have not only their food license, but have a bakery because they bake their own breads, and also a meat because they package their meat products. Some of the other ones are ignoring cease and desist orders, ignoring embargoes, closure orders, and violations of adulterating food. And so these are issues that I think of the short list of folks that they're actually going after versus just the common, you know, coming in and inspection of our facilities. And so we therefore support the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President, Mr. Chairman.
Didn't have said it too long.
You just got a promotion, I guess, so maybe demotion.
I don't want
okay.
it.
Okay.
Welcome to the committee anyway, Mr.
I'm Byer. Roger Byer, here representing the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. The dairy farmers in Oregon, each and every one of which has to have a Class 1 food safety license, and they support this bill. Again, like the grocers, we thought that they had civil penalty authority like they do in virtually every other program the department runs. We also worked with the department in the Senate side to amend the bill down. Originally, as you see, it was a $25,000 civil penalty, which exceeded their other programs. So with that amendment, we are very happy to support this bill and happy to be licensed people with the department. Would like to keep the food safety program intact. Would like to keep a good, healthy reserve in the food safety program in the future so that if an outbreak of food problems comes forward in the state, the department will have the funds available to do something about that. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Looks like you're off easy. Appreciate you testifying
Thank
on
you.
The bill.
So does Les Schwab have a license? I'm just curious.
I don't know. Any other comments on who does? With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 188A. Committee, that concludes our work for today. We will have a little bit longer day on Wednesday, and Friday we will not be having committee, so you know ahead of time. So with that, I will adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.
The award after all. Yeah.